Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and reading today from Charles Spurgeon's autobiography. Well, we've come to a place in the text where things are getting just a little long, and I say it unapologetically. I know that we've been on this a long time. This particular topic, which is called appreciative correspondence, goes on for over 50 pages in the book. It's two full chapters. I've decided we will have to skim. I'm going to cover both chapters today, but not fully. I keep reminding you that this whole thing is available other places, especially at the Puritan hard drive, where you can get not only this, but all kinds of other writings of other great men of God. You'll be totally impressed when you go there. It's puritandownloads.com. Just check out the Puritan hard drive. That's the Stillwaters Revival books. All right, this is chapter 93, and we'll start with the lengthy introduction, but then we will skip to various letters. This is more letters. Although Mr. Spurgeon often found certain portions of his correspondence very burdensome, it was by no means all of that character, and was frequently the medium by which he was greatly cheered and encouraged. For many years, not a week passed, and scarcely a day, without tidings reaching him that his sermons or other printed works had been blessed to the salvation of sinners and the edification and strengthening of believers. And he was also constantly reminded from all quarters of the globe that prayer for yet larger blessing was continually being presented on his behalf. This assurance was most gratefully received by him, and on many occasions he was quite bowed down under the weight of loving sympathy thus sent to him from far and near. A selection of these letters was already given in Volume 3, in the chapter entitled Blessing on the Printed Sermons. So communications of that special character are not inserted in the following pages. But among the thousands of letters which have had to be read in order to decide which should be used, there are very many that, for various reasons, cannot be included in this work. Some are private documents, never intended to be published. And of these, a considerable number came from the archbishops and bishops of the Church of England, and most of them were written concerning individuals who had formerly been Baptists and who were seeking admission into their establishment. Or they related to ex-clergymen who were wishing to enter the Baptist ministry. While some of each class appeared to be acting conscientiously in the steps they were taking, the history of others proved that they were mere adventurers, equally worthless to either church or dissent. Some of Mr. Spurgeon's correspondents completely changed the tone of their letters in consequence of his earnest contention for the faith. But instead of giving specimens of both kinds of epistles, they are omitted altogether. Controversial matters have been to a large extent excluded. Otherwise, a chapter or two might have been devoted to the correspondence which caused considerable excitement, if nothing more. The details of Mr. Spurgeon's career were so constantly proclaimed with more or less accuracy to the whole world that there is the less need in this work to refer to certain topics which are already matters of public knowledge. The letters to and from Mr. Spurgeon would have been sufficient to fill several volumes the size of this present one. Readers will hardly need the assurance that it has been no light task to select those which would be fairly representative of the pastor's busy life. Among the numerous interesting communications which he preserved, but which are not included in this book, are very hearty invitations to visit Victoria and Canada and South Africa, at least partly for rest, and earnest requests to him to take part in various conferences of Baptists or other bodies of believers in Sweden and Norway and so on. Applications for articles in American and other religious and secular papers and magazines were constantly being received, and these will not be in here either, for the purpose of making some sort of classification. Letters from ministerial brethren are inserted first. These will show how widespread and intense was the esteem in which Mr. Spurgeon was held by ministers of the gospel, both in the Church of England and among the various nonconformist denominations. They will also help to cast sidelights upon the pastor's character and work, and so further reveal their far-reaching influence and usefulness. Then there will be letters from American and Canadian friends, miscellaneous letters, and so on. Let's start now with letters from ministerial brethren. And as I said earlier, we will not be reading all of even these. Dear young brother, what a delightful, exciting, encouraging meeting we had last Thursday week in your hallowed sanctuary. The smile of God abundantly rested upon us. It was a little heaven below. Truly, it was good to be there. I'm looking forward with great interest to the evening when we hope you will preach in Finsbury Chapel. When we traveled together from Rittle, I mentioned the evening of the first day of the new year, namely Tuesday, January 1. If nothing comes in the way, I anticipate an August assembly, God's gracious presence, and much good. Due notice will be given, and we hope to gather, witness a gathering and showers of blessing, never to be forgotten. Favor me with a few lines. I return home tomorrow. I need not say how much I was pleased with a certain lady to whom you kindly introduced me. I hope, like yourself, she will acknowledge me as her father. She is everything I could wish. May your fellowship on earth be of long duration and be the sweet prelude of your eternal fellowship beyond the skies. That was from Alexander Fletcher. And then Spurgeon writes back, in those early days, well, we don't have that yet, I'm sorry. Mr. Spurgeon did not preserve so many of the letters he received as he did in later years. So there's a long interval between the one printed above that you just heard and the following. It appears that the pastor and his friend, Reverend Samuel Martin of Westminster Chapel, had both been blessed to a certain individual concerning whom a correspondent wrote to Mr. Spurgeon. He passed on the good news to Mr. Martin, who wrote to him, "My dear friend, your welcome letter and the letter of your friend are in my hand. I thank you for your own loving epistle, and I thank you also for permitting me to read the other letter, and for thus making me a sharer of your joy. What is our hope and joy and crown of rejoicing if not found in such facts as that which so-and-so narrates? Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost. Whenever you feel moved to cast your net in our waters, know and remember that our ship or shore or whatever may be needful to carry out the figure perfectly is at your service. A prayerful and praiseful welcome will always be given you. I have requested one of my deacons to leave at your door a volume, which I beg you to accept. As you read this, ask our Heavenly Father to give me back my power of voice, if it be His will, that I may continue to preach His Son, Christ Jesus, with whom I feel more closely united by means of every affliction which I suffer. What a large letter I have inflicted upon you. Forgive the infliction. The Lord keep you, Samuel Martin." Spurgeon was very grieved whenever illness prevented him from fulfilling his engagements to preach at the tabernacle or elsewhere. On one such occasion, he received from Mr. Chown the following loving, brotherly letter. "My dear friend, I received your secretary's letter last night, announcing your inability to be with us on the 23rd. It will be a great disappointment to our friends, but we will turn our anticipations into sympathy and prayer. May He whose love and wisdom have permitted the stroke give the blessing proportioned to the blow. As the chastening hand is laid upon you, may the supporting arm be underneath and round about you. Many have never felt the Lord so near and precious as in the furnace. May this be your happy lot, and the flames be powerless except to keep off the enemy and burn off all bonds. There are times when our very tears become wellsprings of peace and comfort. May it be thus, beloved friend, with yours. We are all with you in spirit. May God bless you. Forgive this line or two before leaving for Montacut, where two services await me today. Again and evermore, the Lord bless you. Yours very heartily, J. P. Chown." When the Princess Alice steamer sank in the Thames, September 3, 1878, and hundreds of lives were lost, Mr. Spurgeon preached two sermons on the calamity. The following letter refers to the one entitled Divine Interpositions. Reverend and dear sir, this is not the first time that we have exchanged friendly greetings. I am now moved to write to you to ask if your sermon on the Thames collision, as reported in the Daily News, is published in extenso. If so, where can I get it? I am quoting, of course, with approval, a passage from it in my next Sunday sermon, and would like to have your exact words, if possible. One sentence, however, of your discourse leads me to offer, for your kind acceptance, my last new volume on the mystery of pain, death, and sin. You are reported to have said, I do not attempt to justify the ways of God to men, but I believe they are all for the best. Well, I too devoutly believe they are all for the best, but I have attempted to justify them. If you read my book, you must not mind a page here and there sadly jarring on your own feelings, but bravely read straight on, and it is possible you may find much to cheer and strengthen your belief in God's great and unfaltering goodness. I sympathized with you very much in your late illness. I'm very glad you are at work again and hope many years of noble activity are still before you. Charles Voisin. Well, I have to unfortunately skip one or two. Let's move down to this one. At Mr. Spurgeon's pastoral silver wedding, the celebration of which was delayed through his long and serious illness, he was very strongly urged to abstain, as far as possible, at least for a year, from all services away from the tabernacle. One of the ministerial brethren who took an active part in the proceedings on that memorable occasion was Dr. Charles Stanford, and it happened that the pastor was under promise to preach for him at Denmark Place Chapel a few days later. Mr. Spurgeon thought it was extremely kind on his friend's part voluntarily to release him from the engagement, and the way in which he did so added to the value of the action, which was probably unique in Mr. Spurgeon's history, for people were always so anxious to obtain his help, whatever the cost to him might be, that we are not aware that anyone else ever wrote to him another such letter as this. My dear friend, delighted and most grateful as I should have been to have your service in average circumstances, my judgment has always been against allowing you to come on the 28th. I only stated the case and accepted your generous offer because my folks were so anxious that I should do so. Although the bills are out, I have ordered slips with postponed printed in red letters to be passed over them. It is entirely my act and deed, not yours, and if any remarks are made, they will be made about me. It is not likely that I should be a party to risk doing you harm. Now, this will be a conspicuous fact, which can easily be quoted, and which will, I hope, make you able to decline all applications from outside the tabernacle for the next 12 months. May God bless and prosper you richly, still more and more, in all manner of ways. Charles Stanford. In a later letter, Dr. Stanford wrote, purely out of love to you, and at a great loss and self-denial to myself, have I resigned the privilege of your sermon for us tomorrow night. I hardly recollect anything that has cost me so much or that I have been so very, very sorry to give up. When I saw how far from perfect recovery you are and how miraculous your homework is, I felt shocked with a fear that I had selfishly taken advantage of your generosity in allowing you to preach for me, especially at the beginning of your new campaign, so setting an example, and more especially as in the circumstances it looked as if I had some idea of a quid pro quo. I have, however, taken care to make public the fact that it is all my own doing and that you were ready to come to us. An engagement in a little place takes up as much time as in a greater building, and if you had preached for us, no doubt you would have been pestered by many similar applications, which, if you had even partially accepted, might have worn away your working power, all of which is needed for your own enormous apparatus of service. End of quote. Mr. Spurgeon did all he could to compensate for the disappointment by sending a contribution for the fund in aid of which he was to have preached, and also by presenting some of his books to Dr. Stanford, who wrote back to him, my dear friend, you stunned me. I can only say, in a short sum total, thank you. Our school people are also much surprised and obliged by the £10. Your sermons always quicken me because they are so full of God's truth, put in your own way, and are so all alive. Nothing ought to have the very soul and essence of a man in it so much as a volume of his sermons. That's another reason why I'm glad to have some of yours, and I have to move on now. Here's from Dr. Kohlross. My dear Mr. Spurgeon, either you have received or you will immediately receive a letter from D. Anderson, Esquire, another from Mr. Lee, the Free Church minister, aiming to secure a conditional promise from you to preach in Nairn next year in connection with their new place of worship. I have great pleasure in seconding their application. They would endeavor to make your visit as agreeable as possible, and if you could spare the time, a week or 10 days spent there might invigorate you greatly in health. Knowing Mr. Anderson, I'm confident he would lay himself out for this purpose. Your sermons are circulated in great numbers throughout the surrounding district, and a visit from you would be welcomed by thousands. I do not think you've ever preached within many miles of this place. If it were not that I think a visit to Nairn might refresh and strengthen you, I would not write as I do. But it would be a very different thing from coming to Glasgow. We remember your visit here with gratitude. A young man who unexpectedly was idle on the afternoon you preached, and who accidentally was offered a ticket by a friend who was prevented from attending, went out of curiosity to hear you and was led to the Savior. I have since baptized him and received him into church fellowship. Doubtless there are many similar cases of which we do not know. I trust you are again restored after your recent attack. Well, let's see. I'm moving down the line just a little bit. Mr. Spurgeon was very gratified by the receipt of the following letter from one of the fathers of the Free Church of Scotland. Dear Mr. Spurgeon, I am a retired minister. In June of 1821, that was 60 years ago, I began my ministerial work. In August 1876, I ceased to be in charge of a congregation. I then became colleague and minister emeritus of the Free North Church in Stirling. I'm the oldest minister, in point of ordination, in the Free Church of Scotland, the oldest surviving ex-moderator of the General Assembly of the Free Church. And as to my relation to yourself, I have read, I think, everything you have published, down to your last sermon and the latest number of The Sword and the Trowel. I love your writings for their true Puritan ring, and for their soundness, their liveliness, and thoroughly evangelical character. I do what I can to commend you and your great work, believing that in doing so, I am serving our Lord. I am not a Baptist. I have written a little on the other side in my day. But I am a lover of all who love the Lord. On this ground, I claim you as a brother, and I will ever pray that the Master may more and more honor you by making you an instrument of good. With Christian affection and sincere goodwill, I remain very faithfully yours. And again, I have to scroll down. There's just so many of these. 1881 was the year in which the Baptist Union autumnal session was held at Portsmouth and Southampton, and the local committees in both places so energetically supported Mr. Sampson's plea that ultimately Mr. Spurgeon promised to preach in each of those towns. October 26 and 27, he was graciously helped to fulfill the engagements, and none who were present are likely to forget the discourses he then delivered. And early in 1882, Canon Wilberforce asked for tickets of admission to the tabernacle, and shortly afterwards wrote to Mr. Spurgeon as follows. My dear friend, don't get canonical. I would not have you anything but what you are. We were prevented at the last moment from enjoying the privilege of the tabernacle service, but we sent some friends who very greatly appreciated it. Will you come and see us one day again? Would it be possible for you to run down on Monday, March 6, and read the Bible to us at our quiet home Bible reading? how delighted we should be, and we would take such care of you for the night. Or, if absolutely necessary, you could return to London the same evening, though this would be most disappointing to us. Do come. It will be no exertion to you, as there will not be above 20 persons, and you can help us and speak to us of him who has so blessedly used you. My wife sends her most kind regards and begs you to come. Ever most sincerely yours, Basil Wilberforce. Well, other invitations. In the autumn of 1882, when arranging the supplies for the tabernacle pulpit during his absence at Mentone, he sought to secure the services of a Reverend Charles Garrett of Liverpool. This proved to be impossible. The pastor, though, was greatly cheered by this letter from Mr. Garrett. My dear Mr. Spurgeon, many thanks for your welcome letter and its kind enclosure. I shall treasure both while I live. The fact is, I have long been about the most devoted admirer that you have. I have thanked God for giving you to the church over and over again, and I always say that the whole church ought to pray that God may preserve and help you. Hence, you may imagine how I prize your kind gift. As to occupying the pulpit for you, I would do anything in my power to relieve you from either work or anxiety. But this year I am very heavily taxed. Everybody wants me, and all seem to think that, as I am president, they have a claim to me. I am here at our foreign missionary meetings, and then I go for a series of meetings in Scotland. Have you ever preached on the witness of the Spirit? If not, I wish you would. It is a subject on which many are greatly perplexed. Send it to me when it is published. God bless and keep you. Yours truly, Charles Garrett. Skip more. I'm so sorry that I have to do this, folks, but you know, I think we've had a lot of letters. And here's one from Wilberforce again. My. And not the Wilberforce that you're used to hearing about, by the way. My dear friend, I heard today with deep regret from Newman Hall that you are again in great suffering. I was intending to write and ask if you meant to dine at Mr. Alcroft's on Wednesday next, after the Bible Society meeting at which you and I have both spoken. We're going to speak. I was going to say that although I wanted to attend the Liberation Society meeting in the evening, yet if you had decided to dine with the Primate of all England, I would go, too, just to guard your nonconformity from the perversive suasions of an archbishop and a bishop. Imagine their success, bringing you over to Mother Church. Oh, surpliced choirs, processions, and incense in the tabernacle, and yourself invested with cope and chasuble. These are things that you have to wear if you're in the Church of England. To avert such a catastrophe, I thought that I had better go with you. But I am afraid, from what I hear, that you will not be strong enough even to speak at Exeter Hall, to say nothing of the dinner afterwards, so I shall go to the Liberation Society meeting. But, dear friend, I am half afraid that this nonsense is like vinegar upon nitre to you if you're suffering so much. You have one cause for great thankfulness, namely that you, in your gout, do more good than we ordinary creatures can do in our very best health. May you find the old promise to Israel fulfilled in your experience that says, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. Colmer B. Sims. Well, I'm still looking for another one here. These are all about from friends who were fellow ministers of his, giving him encouragement, asking him to come, and him asking them to come. That's how it was during his sickness when he was away. People continued to love him. And as the brother said, he could do more in sickness than they could in health. Let me read this one. My dear brother, blessed as you are, in common with all believers, with divine teaching and with good temper, which all saints are not, I hope you will pardon me who preached the gospel before you were born if I ask you in one of your valuable sermons to say something about Shakespeare, perhaps the greatest genius in his way who ever lived, but certainly a deadly enemy to gospel truth. His plays are getting more and more popular. It is sad to see that even good men are praising him in the pulpit. You have talent and taste enough to appreciate his wonderful power and have some gifts in common with him. But of course, you know that reading his plays and much more, attending public performances of them, can but pollute the minds of such as do so. In a pastorate of half a century, I have thought it wise to consider suggestions made to me, even anonymously, though I do not always agree with them. I often hear you, and always with pleasure. I hope, too, with profit. I have you, for years, given away your sound and scriptural sermons every week. And I tell you, what I have told scores and scores of folks, that you're doing more good than any man in England, except Lord Shaftesbury, perhaps. I said to two clerical brethren, both since bishops, in 1855, I think, I am going to hear young Spurgeon tonight. One of them said, "What? That mountebank?" I heard you in Finsbury Chapel. Before you had got half through your prayer, I said to myself, "This lad is no mountebank." I heard your sermon, not agreeing with all of it, but I said next day, when I saw my brethren at a large clerical meeting, "Spurgeon is no mountebank. I wish I could preach half as well, and I wish as much for most of my brethren." They were both very popular men. One is sleeping in Jesus. The other is one of our few evangelical bishops and a dear friend. I never passed a week without hearing of the good your sermons are doing. A dear old friend of mine told me the other day that his pious aunt, age 90, said she lived upon those blessed sermons. One of my working people said to me yesterday, "I like that Spurgeon. I can understand him." This is one of your best features. You are always intelligible. Let me add, always good-tempered. Best of all, always scriptural. Now, if you're anything like me, you've got to be wondering, this is Bob speaking, what's a mountebank? I pronounced it a little wrong. It's mountebank. And it means a person who let me read it right from my dictionary, a person who sells quack medicines from a platform. He was definitely not a mountebank. Well, we've got to move on to the next chapter. The time is getting away already. That was the first chapter of these kinds of letters. And there's a second coming up. This goes on and on. I'm just amazed at how many there are. Let's go to chapter 94, Appreciative Correspondence. Here's some letters from American friends and Canadian. American and Canadians. How about one from Dwight L. Moody? Dear Spurgeon, thanks. Many thanks for your kind note. I am in hopes that you will be led by the Spirit to preach to young men on Sunday next. Enclosed, I send you a circular that a minister here is sending out in the hope that it will stir up some interest in Britain. In regard to my coming to your tabernacle, I consider it a great honor to be invited, and in fact, I should consider it an honor to black your boots. But to preach to your people, that would be out of the question. If they will not turn to God under your preaching, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. He and Mr. Spurgeon evidently had quite a love for each other. The following year, Mr. Spurgeon helped Mr. Moody in his London mission. This grateful epistle shows how highly his services were appreciated. Again, from Mr. Moody to Charles Spurgeon. 10,000 thanks for your help last night. You gave us a great lift. I wish you would give us every night that you can for the next 60 days. There are so few men who can draw on a weeknight, and I want to keep up the meetings in the East End and West at the same time. It's hard on me to have to speak twice the same evening, and yet I shall have to do it next week, for I cannot get anyone for the West End. Do all you can for the work, and we shall see blessed results. Again, another letter written some years later shows that while Mr. Moody still held Mr. Spurgeon in just as high esteem as before, he consented to preach at the tabernacle one Sabbath during the pastor's absence at Mentone. Dear Mr. Spurgeon, your letter of the 9th is at hand, and in reply, let me say that I'm thankful for your very kind note. It quite touched my heart. I have for years thought more of you than of any other man preaching the gospel on this earth. And to tell you the truth, I shrink from standing in your place. I do not know of a church in all the land that I shrink from as I do from yours. Not but what your people are in sympathy with the gospel that I try to preach, but you can do it so much better than I can. I thank you for inviting me, and Lord willing, I will be with your good people November 20. Will you want Mr. Sankey, or will your own presenter have a charge? Either will suit me. Remember me to your good wife, and accept of my thanks for your letter of cheer. Then there's Mr. Sankey writing to Mr. Spurgeon, one of the many letters which Mr. Spurgeon received from Mr. Moody's singing companion, Ira Sankey, will show in what loving esteem that he held the pastor. Dearly beloved, many thanks for the precious word you gave us yesterday. It was indeed most refreshing to my soul. Is it not a beautiful thought that our Lord's disciples always called him or spoke of him as the Son of God while he was down here on earth, and that he always spoke of himself as the Son of Man? But that when he went up to heaven, John saw him there and then spoke of him or called him the Son of Man. John, no doubt, wanted to hold on to him, even as a brother. I will try to see you again at the tabernacle before I sail on the 18th. I love you very much. God bless you and yours. Ira D. Sankey. Now, that's a pretty special letter, don't you think? People that you know about, have heard about in history, talking with each other, because they lived in the same century. I'm having to scroll down again a little bit. I'm so sorry we have to skip some of these. Again, get the book and you will enjoy all of this yourself, I am so sure. Well, what have we got next? My dear brother Spurgeon, I don't know who this is, I'm just taking one. The present seems a fitting time for me to drop you a line. After a long and successful career as the publisher of your books in America, and I may add, as the introducer of your sermons in book form to American readers. At first, it required very special attention on our part to bring them successfully before American readers. But after a while, the tide turned in favor of your books. We made them well known in every state in our union. We had several valuable friends. The late President Wayland of Brown University gave us important aid by letters that we published, as did the late Dr. Alexander, who had been to London and seen you and heard you preach often with great satisfaction. He called at our office and made himself known in person. I had long known him by reputation as a very able and distinguished divine of the Presbyterian Church. He had noticed that some of our large daily newspapers were attacking you very fiercely, and so he came in to urge us to persevere with the sermons. He said, "Do not be discouraged by the unfavorable criticisms of the press. I've seen and heard Mr. Spurgeon. He's a real diamond that will shine brighter and brighter as the years go by. You can use my name in any way that will help you in the battle." We thought it was very kind of him to say and do what he did, for he was a good man and with very great influence, and he proved a real help to us. Okay, and now, my respected brother, in taking leave of you as your publisher, permit me to congratulate you upon the really great success that has attended the enterprise. Very few English authors have had such prosperity here. I do not think that any preacher and an author of religious books has even begun to come up to you. I hear with great pleasure of the blessing resting upon your home work, so large and so grand in all its proportions. We feel all of a publisher's pride in our popular and good author, and shall follow you with our loving thought to the end of your good work. Yours most truly, Smith Sheldon. Then there's Frederick Douglass, the anti-slavery lecturer. Yes, that Frederick Douglass, writing to Charles Spurgeon. While crossing the Atlantic last September and looking out upon its proud, dashing billows and their varied forms, and thinking of the diversity in the human family, I remarked that we are many as the waves, but we are one as the sea. I had never heard this simile before, and I thought it was original with me. But while reading your sermon, published on the 30th of June, I noticed that you said speaking of the 119th Psalm, its expressions are many as the waves, but its testimony is one of the sea. I am led to ask, is this a coincidence? Or have I unconsciously borrowed from you? Or have you borrowed this formula from me? Through the kindness of a friend, I had the privilege of listening to you a few Sundays ago. It was the realization of an ardent desire born of reading some of your sermons in America, and of what was said to me of you by my friend, Dr. Wayland, a gentleman to whom I have been much indebted for friendly sympathy and advice while battling with slavery and prejudice in America. Very truly yours. Excuse me. Frederick Douglass. Oh, my. A.J. Gordon. A.J. Gordon, you may know that name, right? He was from Boston. Took part in the sermon, a service that was at Exeter Hall. He had consented to preach if Mr. Spurgeon continued too ill to do so. And Mr. Gordon, now writing to Charles Spurgeon, I sincerely trust that you were in no wise injured by your effort on Lord's Day morning. It seems to me that the Lord's help given to you then was the most powerful commentary on your text, "Let him deliver him now." Be assured that I also experienced a great deliverance, for there were hundreds of visitors, our whole missionary conference indeed, who had come to hear you, and I can conceive of no embarrassment greater than that of having to preach to such a disappointed congregation as it must have been in your absence. I pray that God will graciously restore you to full health and cause your bow to abide in strength, even when you are sorely grieved and shot at by the archers. I greatly desire, with Mrs. Gordon, to call on you for a few moments at your home. I should be thankful to know when we can see you. If you are too ill to desire callers, please do not for a moment think of my request, and I shall entirely understand the reason. A.J. Gordon. A.T. Pearson. Another famous name in the Christian church. If my best beloved, if there's any man on the earth I love better than you, I wish you could point him out. And as a little thank offering to God for a personal acquaintance, I send you by my publishers, all bills paid, inclusive of expressage, 50 copies of an evangelistic work for your pastor's college with my loving greetings. I am very sorry that your gout is more troublesome. How I wish and pray that the Lord may keep you yet a score of years, and so on. Florence Nightingale is the next person. Incredible. I don't have to tell you who Florence Nightingale was, do I? You'll have to look that one up. Dear sir, nurse masters of our training school at St. Thomas's Hospital, and who is one of a reinforcement of nurses whom we are sending out to join our nursing staff at the Montreal Hospital, was recently admitted by you to baptism and communion. She spoke of it to me with deep earnestness. It occurred to me that you might, among the young women of your flock, know some, sound in body and mind, who would like to be trained for a hospital nursing life, which has now sufficient reward, both in the good to be done and in the maintenance to be earned, to be attractive to suitable candidates. The harvest is ready, but the laborers are still few. I write under the severe pressure of business and ever-increasing illness, which has kept me a prisoner to my room for years, so you will excuse a brief letter. I have heard that you yourself are frequently afflicted. May I express my deep regret at your suffering and my earnest hope that your life may long be spared. May God be with us all. Lord Shaftesbury, that you've heard about in these readings, my dear friend, the books have arrived in safety. And to the inscription which you yourself have written, I value it highly. I shall add my own, a prayer that my descendants will cherish the volumes as the gift of a man whom their ancestor honored and loved as a private friend, but far more as a powerful, bold, true, single-hearted servant of our most blessed Lord and Savior. Did you get that one? Here's a man that's going to keep these books in the family. Send them far down to his descendants so that they can read Spurgeon too. Thank God. There's another longer letter from Shaftesbury that I won't have the time to read. Oh, there are others, so many others. I'm looking for names that will remind you of someone that you know or that I know, and we may have come past all of those. Havelock. I'm afraid I don't know that name. If you do, I'm so sorry. Here's one from Mr. Gladstone. Oh, my goodness. Mr. Gladstone, you know that name from the government of England of that time? Dear sir, this is to Spurgeon. I thank you very much for your kind note and your good words. And my years make it a great object of desire to be relieved from my present work, but I must be patient yet a little while, and must hope that I may not be utterly spoiled by the undeserved kindness heaped on me from so many quarters, and by commendations entirely beyond my deserts. I hope the autumn will afford me an opportunity of profiting by your kind offer to meet my wishes respecting the services at the tabernacle. I remain, my dear sir, faithfully yours, W. E. Gladstone. And another letter. My dear sir, some time ago you were good enough to promise me a safe seat at one of your services. And if it consists with your convenience to do me this favor on Sunday evening next, when I expect to be in London, I shall hope to present myself at the exact time and place which you may kindly name. Should you desire to postpone your compliance with my request, I shall hope for another opportunity of preferring it 3 or 4 Sundays hence. I remain, my dear sir, faithfully yours, Gladstone. And there's another from Gladstone. Evidently, he was loved in so many circles. But this is rare, that a man who preaches truth is loved by so many in government and elsewhere. Of course, he was hated enough, too, if you're worried about that. Some of you wonder, does everybody have to persecute me? No, not everybody does. But if you're not having any persecution in your Christian walk, got to wonder. Now, I'm talking while I'm scrolling, you understand. And I'm just about, I think, to come to the end of this chapter, too. And we've come surely to an end of our time together. We've spent a lot of time together today, and we'll just have to let it go at that. You get the picture. So many loved this man. Well, we have the works of other great men of God on this website. I don't think anyone's going to top this one in the opinion of so many. Do look around the website when you have time, and go over to Facebook if you like, and check out my timeline there. Click on store on the website. You'll see the books. Go to christfromamongus.com and see the written work that I do. And at YouTube, type in Bob from Hackberry House, and you'll be able to, at this time, learn a little bit about the mystery called Babylon that is right now, I believe, a part of Romanism. But you'll have to go there and check that one out yourself. God bless you. And this is the Hackberry House of Chosun. I hope to talk to you soon. Lord willing, I will.